Thanks for listening to Chicago's Morning Answer podcast, sponsored by Signature Bank. Signature Bank takes pride in helping customers grow their business and provide unmatched banking expertise, custom financial solutions, and the industry's best technology. So whether you're a business looking for a deposit relationship or needs a ready source of financing, Signature Bank is the right bank for you. Call today at 773-467-5600 to hear how Signature Bank can help your business grow and thrive. Member FDIC, Equal Housing Lender.
This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan, and in for Amy J this morning is John Cass, johncassnews.com, and the Chicago Way podcast, which you can also find at johncassnews.com. I had to drop a tale this morning, John. It's our mutual friend, this guy that I brought on our show a couple weeks ago. John Greenfield is his name. And I was explaining to you...
Mr. Hankey?
Yeah, I was explaining to you off the air. So he's got a track on both you and I. And I was explaining to you on the air, off the air, which I'll re-explain now. Is, you know, you see these internet cowboys that are always taking pot shots and saying things that are untrue about you or mischaracterizing positions, calling you the full complement of names. You're this ist and you suffer from that phobia or ism. You know,
anybody who's not them is a fascist or is one of my former editors said they're Christo-fascist.
Crypto.
Christo.
Oh, Christo-fascist.
Christo-fascist, like Christian
fascist. Oh. You know, I see.
That's an editor, former editor of the Tribune that is interested in my powder rooms.
Well, so I always invite these people, why don't you call in and, you know, you're just taking me apart here on Twitter. Why don't you call in and then in real time we'll go back and forth and we'll let, you know, the people decide. And then sometimes when you run into a deep thinker, and how I knew John Greenfield was a deep thinker is he had the Reader on his Twitter bio, so he's affiliated with the Reader. So I know well there
is that the
there's a super smart guy. That's the paper that threw out Len Goldman, the guy who saved it.
Is that the paper that has a columnist?
Len Goodman. Goodman, I mean, yeah.
Supports the use of the human fist as sexual gratification. Is that the one?
Probably. It sounds like the Reader. I'm not sure I know which columnist you're talking about, but it sounds like the Reader. But anyway, so I thought, oh, we'll bring him on. And then after he came on, and then there was all these, you know, you may not interrupt me, you know, and all these things, right? Because it's like, I'm so oppressive in a conversation.
That you invited him on.
Right. Yeah. I'm not going to let him have his say. Right. And so we needed to make sure. So he laid down that ground rule. And then he came on, and we talked a little bit because this was just, I think, the end of the week after the Highland Park parade shooting. So we talked about guns a bit. And then he immediately turned to where I live and where I vote. And then he leapt from me to you, where you live and where you vote. And the upshot is that our collective 115 years in Chicago does not give us the street cred, does not give us the standing to comment on anything that happens in Chicago and Illinois. Only literal technical residents can comment on what happens in Chicago and Illinois. So I just thought I'd let you know, because ever since then, I've not commented on Chicago or Illinois. Well, that's
you know what? I'm afraid to comment because of people like that. I mean, look, this creep issued a series of tweets. I'm almost at Cass's house. I'm almost here. He's taking pictures on his way out to my place. That upset my wife. But what really upset her was that the Chicago Tribune, the paper, did a story about where we live, which she had asked me not to make a big deal about. And it was like, John Cass lives in a town and has a house that's not in Chicago, and he's got hardwood floors and two or three powder rooms. And she was upset because we have bathrooms as well.
You have in addition to the powder rooms?
Right, we actually do take baths.
Oh, do you?
Yeah. And,
oh, wonderful. Tell us all about that, John. I'm reporting for John Greenfield here. Yeah. I want to report back.
Oh, I don't want to. Yeah, I don't. Once I get to the soap, I don't want to get him too.
Yeah, sure.
Too excited,
right?
But that's the point of the Jacobin. The Jacobin will target people. You're not a Supreme Court justice, and I'm neither am I. But it's the same process. They target you. They try to intimidate you. They suggest that you're living somewhere, so you're not in Chicago. I'm not living at 5224 South Peoria anymore. Okay?
Right. Well, you have to go back if you want to comment on Chicago.
Right.
You're not allowed to talk about the mayor's race, according to John Greenfield.
I moved into Chicago while everyone else was moving out. And many of my readers were like, why are you moving into the city?
Right.
I wrote about it. I'm moving into the city. To have the year in Provence, Betty and I would enjoy the restaurants and the ambiance of the Northwest Side and the Bernie Bros and all the rest that comes with it. And guess what? Riots happened. Lori Lightfoot lost control of the city happened. It was a disaster. Living with in high-density populations and knowing that they could erupt again at any moment was a stress that I don't think anybody in Chicago wanted. And you can't take the L. You can't ride the L unless you have a Smith & Wesson on your hip. And
well, here's the thing, too. What
they
I said
could just kiss my behind.
Well, when he was on the show, you know, I challenged him to consider, rather than worrying about where I'm at or where John Cass is at, why don't you contemplate and for our audience, answer the question, why it is that so many people who would have otherwise never left Chicago or Illinois, who never thought they would leave Chicago or Illinois, at least as a resident, are nonetheless doing it and have done so, you know, in seven-figure fashion over the last decade.
Reluctantly.
As you see us losing congressional districts with every census, so that's the leading indicator, despite what Jelly Belly says about the growth that's happening.
People moving
in. That's a lie. Yeah. So maybe you should consider why people who would wanted to stay have left, and he didn't have much to say on that topic, unsurprisingly. But your point about we talked about it a couple of weeks ago with Tom Brekka, the president of Thomas More Society, who the Jacobins, the Neo-Jacobins, came to his home in Evanston, vandalized his home. Police got wind of it. He and his wife were at a dinner party that night anyway. But nonetheless,
I heard that interview.
Yeah, but nonetheless, I mean, it's you understand the principle. You've seen, obviously, what these same types of people have done outside the homes of Supreme Court justices, the assassination plot against Kavanaugh. And then, of course, last week, the assassination attempt on Lee Zeldin, Congressman and Republican nominee for governor in New York.
And again, you know, I don't consider myself on that level of Supreme Court justice, but I'm an American. And when you don't go along with their program, the Neo-Jacobins will come after you personally. And if Dan Proft and I had targeted some Neo-Jacobin writers to attack and mercilessly go after and, you know, threatened to go to their house and take audio and take tweets, you know, this step and that step, and we're almost there, we're almost at the house, what would happen? The FBI would be on our ass. Anyone in journalism would condemn us. They don't condemn them, do they? And when they get control of government, they take everyone out. As parents who are compared to domestic terrorists can attest to.
Michael on the South Side, you're in Chicago's Morning Answer.
Hi. Morning, Dan. Morning, John.
Hey, Mike.
I listened to Dan's interview with John Greenfield in complete horror, partly because I once worked at the Chicago Reader myself. The first question that came to mind when John commented on where you and John live was, what about people who from out of town who donate to local politicians? Should they stop that practice?
Right. Yeah, right.
But the other thing, too, I was really disappointed when the reader attacked Lynn Goldman. And so I posted comment on Goodman, thank you. I posted a comment on Robert Fiedler's website, and I said, look, as a former Reader employee, I was disappointed that the union protested at the man's house. And John Greenfield replied, as a contributor, he wanted to ask what else should the Reader have done in order to, affect, the sale of the Reader. And I was just thinking, what a jerk.
Yeah.
I mean, this guy actually agreed with protesting the man's house, especially after the man had helped save the Reader. What a jerk.
Well, thanks for the call, Michael. This is a good point that both you, John, and Michael now have brought up. So they went after the owner of the Reader that saved them, Len Goodman, who we had on the show. We have some disagreements, but he seems like a nice, thoughtful guy.
Good lawyer, even though he didn't get Rod Blagojevich out of prison.
Yeah, So, remembering my history, please correct me if I'm wrong, French Revolution, which is...
Reign of Terror.
Yeah, which is where, Jacobin derives, and thus Neo-Jacobin applies to this cadre of folk in modern times.
CTU, SEIU, trolls on Twitter.
But to your point, I'm not a Supreme Court justice. Well, I'm not a congressman or nominee for governor. Right, but... that was not the limit of their targets. Public officials were not the limit of their targets. Intellectuals, journalists, academics. When the purge, the Reign of Terror, was affected, it was anybody who had any sort of social standing, who had any sort of following that was not on the program, they went to the guillotine.
They took me to the guillotine when I was at the paper for daring to try to warn people about Soros prosecutors, Kim Fox, and others across the country in the growing sense of lawlessness. And the Tribune went along with them and moved me from page two, capitulating to the Jacobins.
I guess San Francisco and Baltimore are now full of anti-Semites, too, as they've dumped Bodine and Mosby, respectively. Mm-hmm. Jim in LaGrange.
John, Dan, how are you? John, this... I just want to ask you this question. Is the media the new mob? Because in the old days, John, I used to attend the beer can chicken sessions at Cantini when you would chat about, the threats and the innuendos, and they're coming after you and they drive by your house and things like that. And this is eerily reminiscent of that to me, where the media is now taking the place of an illegal organization. Thoughts on that?
Thanks, Jim.
I forgot, Jim. Thanks for reminding me. I had written about the Duffs and Daly and mafia connections, etc. And they came after me at Gene and Giorgetti's asking me, why aren't your kids playing in the front lawn of your house? And Joe Tiber was there, a former spokesman for the Illinois Supreme Court. Tom Servin was there. And Leroy Martin was there, and they couldn't believe it. And they act the same. It's the same way. Power, thugs, we will break you and bend you to our will. All you have to do to release the pressure is kiss their hand. But I'm Greek, and we don't do that.
The difference, it seems to me, is that actual outfit guys never cast themselves in a sanctimonious light like they were holier than thou. So the behavior is similar. It's just the moral indignation is layered on by the press corps types and these other neo-Jacobins we're talking about.
After that Duff thing, I wrote about it, and thousands of people wrote to me that they would stand in front of my driveway, watch out for my family. I've never forgotten it. And even when I left the Tribune and started my own thing, johncastnews.com, I've always been writing for those people. Always.
Kevin Northfield.
Hey, guys, great to hear you two together. Yes, it's the opposite of the Christ, turn the other cheek, act with love. It's might makes right. It's the thuggery and the most sad, cynical view of the world. Ends justifies the means. I wanted to make a brief point, and that is, as a kid, you too will remember what I remember, and that is anyone who was graced enough to live in a Chicagoland town that was a really nice town, call it the North Shore, call it any place that was really nice, you wanted to die in your house. You wanted to live your life, send your kids to college, see them succeed. You wanted to die in your house. We all did. Now, I live in the North Shore, and the minute the youngest kid gets out of high school, boom, they're gone. Everyone is gone, myself included. Northwest Indiana beckons, and what I don't understand is why everyone in Chicagoland doesn't realize that Northwest Indiana is Chicagoland without the downside, without the high taxes, without the crime, without the ridiculous corruption. It's twice the lifestyle. It's half the price. I don't understand why everyone doesn't hop right over the border because the housing prices are so much less. I'm living in a house. It's a $500,000 house in Chicago. I'm moving to Indiana. My $500,000 house in Chicago pays about $13,000 in taxes. My $500,000 house in Indiana pays $1,000 a year in taxes.
But we don't want you because we don't want people coming in now. We've got a great town, got a great community. We don't need these Chicago people coming in with their ways, their Chicago ways.
Yeah, yeah, right. Thanks for the call, Kevin. Thanks. Appreciate it.
The stories you need to know to start your day. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560.
Business owners, now's the time for your business to make the move to a locally owned business bank. Hi, Mike Gallagher here to let you know that you don't have to look far. Signature Bank was founded in Chicago with a simple mission to help companies like yours grow, succeed, and thrive. Their decisions are made locally by a terrific team that knows your name, cares about your business, and invests in your success. That's why Signature Bank is my bank. I'm a customer. As business owners, they knew that local family-owned businesses were not getting the help they needed or deserved. So, I invite you to reach out to my friends at Signature Bank today. Write the number down. Remember this phone number, Signature Bank, 773-467-5630, and learn all about this great bank, 773-467-5630, or visit them online at signaturebank.bank. That's signaturebank.bank. Signature Bank makes commercial banking personal. Member FDIC, Equal Housing Lender.
This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy, John, except for in for Amy this morning, is John Cass of johncassnews.com. And John, you were just, you just mentioned last hour the CTA.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, and this morning we have word a man killed in a stabbing on the Red Line at about 3 in the morning on the 200 block of West 63rd, stabbed to death, got into an altercation with another dude.
On the podcast that I do, the Chicago Way, we have Jeff Carlin and I have John O'Malley, the deputy, former deputy mayor for public safety. And he rides the CTA at night. And I said, he goes, I have a friend. I ride with a friend. And I said, what's your friend's name? Sig? And he said, no, Smith and W.
Yeah, right.
But but not everyone is ready to carry a gun just to ride the CTA.
And first of all, you're not allowed to.
Right.
Yeah.
It's no gun zone.
Yeah, it's a gun-free
like
zone.
All of Chicago is no gun zone.
That's why it's so safe, the CTA, because it's a gun-free zone.
Right.
Over the weekend, I got this missive from the Shakespeare Theater. The Bard would be upset. We are saddened to share that last night's Chicago Shakespeare in the Parks performance in Columbus Park was suspended due to gunshots in the vicinity. Everyone is safe. No one is injured. But we recognize and are concerned about how unsettling and distressing this was for all involved. Responding directly to the needs of our team who were in the park last night, we have decided that performances tonight in Ogden Park and tomorrow in Pingtown Memorial Park will not go on as scheduled. Chicago Shakespeare Theater is providing resources and support to our company members, and we're working with our community partners and the Chicago Park District to plan for future engagements in communities that will have missed performances. We remain committed to the neighbors and communities that have made the Chicago Shakespeare in the Parks program so dear to our hearts for 11 years. We'll be back, and we'll continue to create together. We just don't know when, is my parenthetical remark. We'll be back at some point, maybe.
But the Tribune has time to go after my house and my wife and my family.
Traumatized Shakespeare theater types. It's a serious thing because it goes to quality of life. It's not the most serious thing, but it's a serious thing. Quality of life. Shakespeare in the Park, we can't do it. It's not safe.
Right, because the bean.
All of these leftists, and, you know, again, before they became COVIDian lunatics, I was a patron of the Shakespeare Theater, wonderful theater company. They do great performances. And it's great that they do performances in the park so that people can access their work free. But, of course, they can't because, you know, bullets. They can't because, you know, gunfire in the vicinity.
They can't because, Dan, not bullets, not guns. They can't because barbarians have guns and shoot at people in crowded areas.
And they can't because the political leadership of the city has turned the city over to them. And so who gets hurt the most? Whose quality of life declines the most? Not me. I could still go to the Shakespeare Theater if I wanted. But people who can't afford $60, $90, $120 ticket to go enjoy a little culture, which is, by the way, one of the value adds you're supposed to receive by living in a big urban environment. Not so much. And then, as I mentioned before Mike Scott's newscast, a reminder that there is no sanctuary from the violence in Chicago. Not for Shakespearean actors in the park, and not for churchgoers on the South Side at a funeral mass. This is Pastor Donovan Rice, on the shooting that occurred outside of a church in Roseland, his church, after funeral service over the weekend.
On a day when there's, you know, people should be coming together, people should be growing, should be loving, and now there's a community in confusion, in chaos. It should be a time of grieving, but of love, you know, of rethinking the path, and so it's just a shame that this would happen in that type of situation, and it may be a sign that things are just, you know, getting worse.
You think?
Pastor, I think you're right. But it's been worse, and it's getting even more worse.
Universal Community Missionary Baptist Church, 100 block of East 108th Street in Roseland. That's where this occurred.
It'd be interesting to see if that same church endorsed, like as did Lori Lightfoot, the election of Kim Fox, State's Attorney Cook County.
Well, right. I mean, it's getting worse. It would be interesting to hear some the people in charge. Those are the people that you wanted. Mm-hmm. And how's that going? And how much worse does it have to get before you consider doing something different when November 8th rolls around, for example, when February rolls around, for example? Roseland resident Sherry Roan, she heard the shooting.
I hear something go pop, pop, pop. I said, my husband, I say, they shooting out there. He ran to the door. I was like, you come back. What are you running out there for? You know what I'm saying? So it's just getting bad. You know, you just got to pray to God. You know, it's just terrible.
Mm-hmm.
They don't deserve what's happened to them, but deserves have nothing to do with it.
Community activist Andrew Holmes, he had an interesting observation or two.
We got to find out who these individuals are, and I'm saying it over and over again. When these detectives put that paperwork to that state's attorney's office, we're going to have to do more and keep these people inside of there. And this starts at home.
Oh, that's a lot in 10 seconds. Mention of the state's attorney's office, keep people inside of there. What do you think he's talking about? And it starts at home. Yeah. 312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line. 646-36-DA, turnkey.pro text line. Story in the Tribune you directed my attention to, John, because, you know, I rarely read it, because why?
I'm not a subscriber.
Downtown Chicago is busy, but office workers are missing. That's what's missing from the city, office workers.
It's great. They have a story saying, oh, the tourists are back. It's all wonderful. Everything's great. But what's missing? Office workers. You know why office workers are missing, Trip? And you didn't cover it, just like you don't cover bond court. You don't cover judges. You don't cover what Kim Fox is doing. You don't cover any of that. But you know why people are why office workers are missing? They're afraid to get on the L, and their companies don't want them to be down there because they'll get stabbed or shot or threatened. And the majority of office workers, by nature, are not barbarian warlords. So maybe being on the L, it might be too much for them. And I understand that because they're civilized people.
Well, and going back to Roseland for a second, because I wanted to make this point, that's a community that was destroyed by the government.
Yep.
We've mentioned on the show before, but that was a upwardly mobile, middle-income, black neighborhood in Chicago 50 years ago. And then what happened? Go back and read the Tribune accounts, which I have. What happened is they tore down those human warehouses called public housing projects, and then they sent people to neighborhoods like Roseland and to South Suburban communities who were not prepared to be homeowners, who didn't have a stake in the game. And if you go back and read the Tribune accounts of the exporting of public housing residents to these neighborhoods, the black residents of Roseland didn't want it. We don't want people that are affiliated with gangs, people that don't have a stake in the system, people that haven't made their own way like we have in our neighborhood. It has nothing to do with race. Obviously, it was black people talking about other largely black people. It has to do with, wait a second, they don't play by the rules. We play by the rules. That's how we built this lovely neighborhood.
Not only did they play by the rules, but if you think of what a black couple had to go through to just amass the money needed to put a down payment, that's hard, hard work for anybody, especially for a black couple that has other difficulties, at least at the time. A cop, a nurse, working their tails to the bone. And then the Democratic Party shuts down the projects, ships everybody out into your neighborhood, and the old neighborhood, the neighborhood of projects, are magically repositioned and redeveloped for rich white people.
Well, but
how's that work?
But here's the thing: the conversation is almost exclusively about the release of these Clockwork Orange kids on, like locusts into to neighborhoods, and then they've destroyed neighborhoods like Roseland with crime.
Predictable.
But that's not the whole story. You have to go back a little bit, particularly in some neighborhoods like Roseland, and say it didn't used to be that way. It didn't have to become that. It was a choice that was made by, well, frankly, the Irish Mafia downtown as to that sealed Roseland's fate. And maybe, and by the way, and every other non-member of the Irish Mafia, including Tiny Dancer and Triple Threat, that have followed in recent years. So you understand, I mean, talk about Stockholm Syndrome. It's next level Stockholm Syndrome. I don't just identify with my captor. I identify with a person who literally destroyed my community. the people that literally destroyed my community, the political ruling class on the fifth floor, no matter who is the, you know, the head of city du jour.
Any surprise why 200,000 African-Americans left the city?
No.
Because of that and similar decisions on schools, same thing.
They better not have moved to Northwest Indiana or John Greenfield may track them down.
Well, that's what you have is the enforcement arm is the white Jacobin, fake journalists like this.
John and Crown Point, you're on Chicago's Morning Answer.
How you guys? How you doing?
Hello.
Hey, I miss Amy a lot.
Yeah. we'll pass along your well wishes.
Hey, I heard they're renaming that Shakespeare in the Park thing to Shots in the Park.
Hi-o. Thanks for the call, John. Yeah, where, by the way, where's the Henry IV daring of those Shakespearean actors?
There was a time when Shakespeare was involved in at a time when there was great violence, right?
Well, I'll tell you, also, too, I mean, it's a remarkable in this city. Of where we're tearing down statues that the overlords allow for Shakespeare in the park because as English departments have purged Shakespeare from
perfect,
you know, right. I'm surprised the Shakespeare Theater and the Shakespearean actors in the city have survived. Interesting piece in the Journal about Baltimore, which has applicability to Chicago. This is by a policy wonk at the Maryland Public Institute. The number of murders that could have been prevented in that were preventable could have been prevented in Baltimore, which on a per capita basis, I believe, is worse than Chicago. 2,500 homicides since 2015 in Baltimore. Many of these killings could have been prevented. My analysis of court records and police data suggests if the justice system had worked as intended. Look no further than the case of Deontay Walker, convicted of the January 2020 murder of Justin Antonio Johnson. Less than 3 years before the killing, Mr. Walker was charged with at least 10 counts and possibly more. The state's attorney's the office of the state attorney, Marilyn Mosby, cut him a deal for a guilty plea to two charges, robbery and conspiracy to commit robbery. Although he faced a maximum sentence of 15 years for each count, he received only two, was freed months before he killed Johnson. He was found guilty in December of 2021 of second-degree murder and firearms offenses and sentenced to 50 years in prison. Baltimore murders are typically committed by criminals with lengthy rap sheets who often serve minimal time or are released early. And this is a story, of course, that, you know, reverberates through Chicago. But just to give you some perspective in Baltimore, so you probably could extrapolate something similar here, more than half of the 110 homicide defendants whose cases I examined were previously convicted of serious crimes under Mosby. At least 61 of those 77 were convicted of an offense whose eligible jail term would have made it impossible for them to commit their alleged homicides. So more than half, 77 of the 110 homicide defendants whose cases he looked at, and a majority, supermajority of those, would have been in jail, impossible for them to kill the person they did on the day that they did, had the sort of sentences provided by law been imposed, well, been asked for and sought and imposed by Mosby and the Baltimore justice system. Mosby now is out as the state's attorney for the city of Baltimore.
But one thing, she was backed by George Soros as...
No, of course.
As was Cook County State's Attorney Kim Fox. And again, I'm telling everybody, and I'm going to repeat it, and I should take an ad out in the Tribune. I stood up for the readers and the people of Chicago to try to warn them about this, and I was vilified, and the newspaper did not back me and move me off page two.
But the Mosby thing too, you know, lest you think that there's some awakening going on in Baltimore. I mean, part of it is that she's under federal indictment for mortgage fraud. So that may have, you know, it's maybe a combination of the two. Maybe there's a little bit of an awakening there. It's just like there's a little bit of an awakening in San Francisco where they recalled Chesa Boudin, who was reared by the Weathermen, reared by Ayers and Dorn.
Raised
maybe
by wolves in Chicago.
Maybe. I mean, at least there's some action being taken by the electorate for whatever reason in both of those venues. What action is being taken in Chicago?
I don't know what the Baltimore Sun wrote about Mosby and her crime-fighting ability. I do know that the Tribune has been, and the Sun-Times, have been woefully inadequate in covering bond courts here. Now, CWB Chicago does that, you know, and so every once in a while you'll see another story. Like the 86th case of a defendant who is out on bond for another gun charge, either shooting, killing, or trying to kill someone else.
Right.
You don't see that in the Chicago papers, and you don't see that in Chicago media.
Which is fine, because
It
is fine, because the CWB has replaced the Tribune on that score.
Yeah.
And, I mean, the Tribune's irrelevant, and it's fine. The Tribune can just go away with the AFL-CIO, NPR, Times. And the rest of it, just go away. That's fine.
So I guess I don't need to take an ad in that irrelevant nonsense.
Spend your money more wisely.
This is Chicago's Morning Answer.
Your show keeps me alive during the week. There's nobody I'd rather listen to between 5 and 9 in the morning than you guys.
On AM 560, The Answer.
Hey, business owners, is your business and money in good hands? Does your bank invest in your success? Hi, Mike Gallagher here, letting you know that when you need a relationship bank, Signature Bank makes commercial banking personal. I love these guys. Not only do they have expansive industry experience, a strong financial track record, but they're also highly capitalized for strategic growth. That's so important. That's why Signature Bank is my bank. They know what it means to grow a business by designing solutions that are right for you and only you. These are real people. They're ready to help. So reach out to my friends at Signature Bank. Make the call today, 773-467-5630. Or visit them online at signaturebank.bank. That's signaturebank.bank. Your business could be Signature Bank's next success story. Go online, signaturebank.bank. Member FDIC, equal housing lender. Signature Bank.
Don't miss Cigar Night with Dennis Prager, Dan Proft, and Sean Thompson on Thursday, August 18th. Get your tickets today at 560theanswer.com/cigar.
Top of the morning, Dan, and in for Amy J. This morning, John Cass of johncassnews.com, columnist extraordinaire and podcaster. And on the columnist extraordinaire piece, John, have you ever demonstrated the courage of the New York Times editorial columnists to devote an entire column to something that you were wrong about as a way to heal the nation the way the New York Times editorial contributors are doing with their I was wrong about ... fill in the blank?
I almost feel like writing a poem about sincerity and hypocrisy, but I think Rudyard Kipling has done it with the Tears of the Crocodile, right? Because, I don't know, the New York Times columnist commenting on their sins without mentioning Did they condemn their own newspaper for accepting a Pulitzer Prize on a fake Russia hoax, the Russia collusion hoax?
They're not sorry about that. The sorries come more in the form of, well, let me give you an example. Literally, I was wrong about, and there's like eight different editorial contributors.
Like popular girls in a high school.
Yeah, this is supposed to, this is their olive branch, you see, they're extending to the hoi polloi, you unwashed masses listening, to show you how self-aware they are, to show you that you are still to revere them.
I'm just laughing at the photo of Paul Krugman in the New York Post. Like, he's got a little pouty face. Like, he's like, oh my God, don't you like me?
This is their effort to provide the leadership to bridge the divides between us, you see.
Yeah, after you've destroyed journalism, just like everybody else.
And they come in the form, like, for example, Gail Collins. I was wrong about Mitt Romney and his dog. This is from a decade ago. When Romney was, this is from her, when Romney was running for president, I tried to see how many times I could find a way to mention that the candidate once drove to Canada with a dog named Seamus. Strapped to the roof of his car. The result was sort of epic. People wound up counting, and I used the story more than 80 times, which was kind of a lot.
Kind of. That's the New York Times for you. Kind of.
Wow.
OMG, Michelle Goldberg.
Gail Collins.
Oh, was it Gail Collins?
Yeah, what an admission. And, of course, I was wrong about Romney and his dog. First of all, I mean, it's just... Who the hell cares? What are you talking about? I mean, and who the hell cares about Gail Collins? And I've never heard of her, Dan, so why are you talking about her? I get it. But this is Mitt Romney, somebody that is an ally, largely, of the D.C. press corps now. So it's okay, now that we're a decade removed from the character assassination, to prop up our guy for a second term. Now it's okay for me to come in and look magnanimous and say, you know what, I apologize for that. That was just, unfair play on my part at the time. So that's one example of it. The other example, or another example, is David Brooks.
Oh, the City News Bureau guy, right? The Chicago expert.
David Brooks, Obama's favorite Republican.
Yeah, right.
I was wrong about capitalism. How David Brooks continues to be perceived or be referenced as some sort of, you know, right-leaning, conservative, Republican, whatever. It's just obscene, but it persists decade after decade. And he's supposed to be one of the great thinkers, you know, the Brooks and Capehart dissertation or distillation of the news on PBS and stuff, right?
Horse poop, okay? I would be more impressed if Dean Baquet came out of retirement or wherever he went, and because we used to work together, and wrote a column saying, "Well, I was wrong for not firing these jamokes. I should have fired them all."
First of all, Brooks starts out by talking about what a free marketeer he was.
Yeah.
In the 80s and 90s
on PBS with. The resident liberal Fleck.
Then he writes his here. So what's his apology? Why is he apologizing? I was wrong about capitalism. I started writing columns about inequality. I called around to my right leaning economist friends, and they sensed inequality was a problem. But few had done much work on the subject or done much thinking on how to address it. Because it's endemic. But okay, I saw but didn't see. Ooh. By the time the financial crisis hit, he's talking about 2008. Apparently, nobody here has been wrong about anything for at least a decade. But okay.
I'm sorry about the dog.
By the time the financial crisis hit, the flaws in modern capitalism were blindingly obvious. But my mental frames still didn't shift fast enough. Barack Obama was trying to figure out how to stimulate the economy. And I still had that 1990s, the deficit is the problem mindset. I wrote a bunch of columns urging Obama to keep the stimulus reasonably small, columns that look wrong in hindsight. Deficits matter, but they were not the core challenge in 2009. I opposed Obama's auto bailout on free market grounds, and that was wrong, too. These momentous mea culpas.
You know, when they do the pouty face?
Holy cow.
When they look up at the camera and do the pouty, oh, I was wrong, too, with their, like, as if they're a dog that just got caught crapping on the bathroom floor or living room floor, that's when you want to jump in and grab them by the scruff of the neck and slap them a couple times in the mouth. Not that I support violence, but maybe sometimes it would feel good. Feel good, like, shut up.
If you really want to understand, the D.C. press corps and their self-reverential attitude, pick out two or three of these. They're quick reads, and read them.
Better yet,
they're so put upon to issue these apologies.
Better yet, let Salem pay for us to go to the White House Correspondents' Dinner or the Gridiron Dinner, and we can sit there and do a video piece mocking all these fools as they dance and caper about and prance like mincing minions. for their betters.
The David Brooks thing, I mean, just a quick comment to that. I was wrong about modern capitalism. He's wrong about what he's wrong about. Brooks starts from this premise that what we had is something akin to unfettered free markets in the 80s and 90s. And that is what drove us to the 08, 09 crises and subsequent crises. Not moral hazards created by the state, but to unfettered free exchange between consenting adults, which we've never had. We didn't have then. We don't have now. It's not the proximate cause to any of the ills that David Brooks sees. And it was certainly government intervention, throwing money at the automakers, or $800 billion in shovel-ready products were not the answers either. But you really should take a walk through some of these pieces, because it just gives you such insight into the mentality that you're dealing with in all of the institutions that are headed up by these leftists in America, and that would be all of America's institutions. So if you want to know thine enemy, then you should read this.
Look, this fool David Brooks wrote a book called The Road to Character, in which he talks about we worry too much about shallow accomplishments and not enough about the more meaningful behavior that truly makes a difference in the world, okay? And then he goes out and stands and parrots and prances. All he needs is like pantaloons, velvet pantaloons in some salon, like a monkey parading as a man.
He is a risible figure, and he is
fool.
And right, this like thoughtful guy trying to figure, like, he is vacuous.
I would send Harvey Keitel, who was in The Duelist, to go meet him and just say "la," and then it would be over.
How about Bret Stephens?
Oh my God, another one. Is that the fake conservative at the New York Times?
Yeah, the conservative from the Wall Street Journal, yes, who went over to the New York Times and started advocating for a repeal of the Second Amendment.
Right.
I was wrong about Trump voters. Ooh.
It's a little twinge of regret.
I was wrong about Trump voters. Right. In 2015, Bret Stephens wrote, "If by now you don't find Trump appalling, you're appalling." Stevens wrote that he stands by the dozens of columns denouncing Trump as a unique threat to American life, democratic ideals, and the world itself. I regret almost nothing of what I said about the man and his close minions, but the broad swipe at his voters caricatured them and blinkered me.
Blinkered you? What copy editor allowed that to go through? What does that mean, sir? What does that mean, red pencil, several exclamation points? What does this mean?
I think he meant it to mean blinded, but
kind of like he's got blinkers on.
Yeah,
kind of distracted him.
He regrets the caricature of Trump voters as appalling. He also writes, it also probably did more to help than hinder Trump's candidacy. Oh boy, there's somebody waking up to the reality of the rejection of the Bret Stevenses of the world. In my dripping condescension toward his supporters, I was also confirming their suspicions about people like me.
Ah, delicious. Go on.
What Trump supporters saw was a candidate whose entire being was a proudly raised middle finger at the self-satisfied elite that had produced a failing status quo.
In other words, he's a stupid fool who didn't realize that Trump was a symptom of everything that was wrong in the country, not the cause of it.
Well, he was a vehicle to express, right? So Bret Stephens is coming around 6 years after Victor Davis Hanson announced what the Trump candidacy was to the realization of what the Trump candidacy was and what it meant for the people that supported Trump against the people like Bret Stephens.
Dan Proft always likes to look beyond the headline, so I offer this to Dan.
Yes.
Is this what is this about? Is it about a fear of what's coming in November? Is it about a fear of realignment and wanting to be on the right side of the curve? What is this about?
I think I go back to what David Mamet said in this interview that he did with Adam Carolla several weeks back that we played and we mentioned a couple times now because I thought it was such a great insight, which is what you come to expect from Mamet. Great insight into the human condition. The thing that people like the New York Times editorial contributors fear the most, irrelevance. They can't be ignored.
They're alone in a room and no one's come to see them cry.
Yeah. That's what I think this is. And so look at us. Look at us apologizing.
I'm sort of
apologizing.
Apologizing about the dog on the roof and the binders of women, I suppose. I don't know. I didn't
realize. Oh, and you got to, by the way, you also have Paul Krugman. I apologize. I was wrong about inflation.
That's the best. The mug on that guy.
Yeah, he came out of his shire long enough to write this guy. Some warn that the package, meaning the Biden funny money plan, would be dangerously inflationary. Others were fairly relaxed. I was team relaxed. As it turned out, of course, that was a very bad call. Oh.
You were team. In other words, you were part of a team, Paul.
Team relaxed.
You weren't just a pimp that they decided to front the story with. You were a part of a collective team.
I don't want... Cool. You can't ignore the left because, as I just mentioned, they have command control over
the culture.
The culture and so many of the associated civic institutions, as well as the
newspapers,
executive, legislative, and judicial institutions in many states and to some extent at the federal level as well.
And the means by which we translate all that into words. Yeah.
But always remember the premise, right? Remember what informs their behavior, and this to me is just prima facie evidence of what Mamet was talking about. They are becoming irrelevant. They are disappearing, and this is a way for them to try to, you know, maintain their connection to what's going on. That their importance in understanding what's going on because it is dissipating with the speed of the daily newspaper.
Well, they trashed journalism in order to appeal to their Jacobin friends. And now they worry that they have destroyed the one place they could stand in a storm. They have the Chicago Tribune has trashed journalism. The Sun-Times is basically the AFL-CIO mouthpiece. WBEZ, all that stuff. It is nothing. They're not doing... Because they're not relevant to the people. They're not doing stories that people care about, like CWB, like how many monsters have been let out from Kim Fox's jail today to kill us.
They woke up 6 years after Trump's victory and found out that they are not the vanguard of the downtrodden that they claim to be. You know how we know? Because the downtrodden are saying so. That's the thing. And by the way, Katie Turr just last week on MSNBC.
Oh, yeah, another one.
You know, the MSNBC, Keith Olbermann's former old lady. She was out there saying this interview where she said, you know, I don't know if the way that I do journalism these days is doing more harm than good. I mean, it's sort of like, you know, if they hear it loud enough for long enough, they finally actually ask themselves the question. It just takes decades.
A hat tip to Dan Proft, who had this brilliant analyst on a couple weeks ago, Nicholas Cass. You may have heard
of him. Oh, yes.
And he wrote about the American Kemalists in the deep state. At least the Turkish Kemalists weren't weak-willed and weakling and simpering and apologizing. These Kemalists who work for the news media are pathetic in their weakness.
Jim in Tampa, Florida.
Hey, guys. Good morning. I think that this is about clearing the decks so that when the next attack comes, they can say, we were wrong about that, but on this, we are not wrong, people.
Right. Yeah, right. Thanks
but we're right about monkeypox? Yeah.
Yeah. Right. We've shown an ability to call ourselves out, to self police. Say, well, hey, when I do something wrong, I'm the first one to take ownership of it. You know, it usually takes 10 or 12 years, and it's going to be on something very minor,
because
like Mitt Romney's dog. But
I speak truth to power.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
I'm.
Yeah, I speak truth to power.
Brent Stevens.
Oh, just really.
Yeah. Loser.
It would have been better for them had they not done this, but I'm so glad that they did.
You're listening to Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer. This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan, and in for Amy J. this morning, John Cass of johncassnews.com. And, John.
Delicious. That's all I got to say.
Author Stephen King, who's a big supporter of Zelensky in Ukraine, you know how I know, is because in this episode of Punked Russian Edition, he's wearing a Ukraine t-shirt and Ukraine hat. He is on a call with someone he believes to be Ukrainian President Zelensky, and they got him to say things he may regret saying.
People who are really love Ukraine, yeah, it's not Nazis. It's Azov. They love some people like Bandera. It's our national hero. So what do you think about Bandera? He was in the Second World War, and he fought against Soviet Union. But yeah, he had some crimes, but it's not so big crimes. It's of course accidentally were crimes against Jews, but you know, it's really important to keep him opposed to Putin and his propaganda.
Well, yes, I mean, you can always find things about people to pull them down. Washington and Jefferson were slave owners. That doesn't mean that they didn't do many good things for the United States of America. There are always people who have flaws. We're human. You know, there are things that we do that are bad choices, and then there are things that we do that are great choices. So, you know, on the whole, I think Bandera is a great man, and you're a great man, and viva Ukraine.
Thank you very much.
What a moron. Here's a mutsa for you. Nah! Eat it. Eat all five.
Yeah, for those not steeped in Ukrainian history, Stepan Bandera, I mean, he's a complicated figure. I'll be that generous, but he was a Nazi collaborator who was, through his organization, Ukrainian Nationalists, involved in the massacre of some 60,000 Poles, 133,000 Jews during World War II, during the Holocaust.
But all you have to do is wrap it up in a Ukraine flag like a tweet, and idiots like Stephen King will jump at it and say, man, you're wonderful.
That's just an excerpt, but they convinced King to consider writing a screenplay backing the Azov Regiment, you know, there are neo-Nazi elements of the Azov Regiment. There's no question about that. But Stephen King is not doesn't hold himself out to be a geopolitical thinker, although I guess to some extent he does. But we don't. So, well, why do we take this seriously? Because he's sort of an example of the zeitgeist,
of course,
of the, you know, what are the cultural fads. Put
a Ukrainian flag on it, and then you will jump at it.
Yeah, I mean, it's just,
put a rainbow flag, and then we'll jump at it. Same thing.
Aren't you a little embarrassed? And so, how are things actually going? And what is our national security interest? And can we push some of the celebritization of complicated geopolitical issues to the side? Well, many members of Congress don't seem to be able to, nor does this president, but Our next guest can. He is Lieutenant Colonel Jim Carafano, VP of the Catherine and Shelby Cullen Davis Institute for International Studies at the Heritage Foundation, author of Brutal War, Jungle Fighting Papua New Guinea, 1942. Jim, would you like to star in the Stephen King screenplay on the Azov Regiment?
Oh, he needs the Yahoo of the Year award, if there is such a thing. First of all, that guy didn't even sound like Zelensky.
Yeah, exactly.
And second of all, kind of red flags here, dude, that Zelensky would make a comment to an American that is pro-Nazi and anti-Semitic. I mean, that Zelensky would be that stupid, even if he was pro-Nazi and anti-Semitic, which he's not.
It's some small crimes. Some small crimes against Jews, not big crimes.
Yeah, right.
Like slaughtering them. Right.
Like anybody is not. Look, we have to be honest. I mean, this is part of the problem, and this is why this. We should talk about how did Ukraine become a partisan issue, because Stephen King is a great example of somebody who is for Ukraine, because Biden is a Democrat.
Right.
If Donald Trump was supporting the Ukrainians today, Stephen King would have his pink hat on and he would be marching, you know, anti-war protests in front of the White House. And I think, you know, we as conservatives have to be smart about this. You know, people cannot be against supporting Ukrainians just because Democrats are for it, even though this president has been demonstrably terrible at actually undermining bipartisan support. And there are a lot of legitimate concerns about how we support Ukraine. 99.99% of them have to do with what a Yahoo we have in the White House and how terrible he is at managing this, and not really much about Ukrainians themselves, who for all their flaws and governance are fighting for their survival and their freedom, and they are doing the fighting and they are doing the dying, and we ought to remember that. The Ukrainian soldiers were dying at a rate of 100 a day. It's now down to about 30 a day. And at the height of fighting, when 100 Ukrainians a day were dying in the field, over 100,000 Ukrainian men went back to Ukraine. And these are people that left and came back to the country, men and women, to fight for their country. So a lot of people talk about corruption. And ironically, there's two things about it. One, ironically, is this government has done more to bring that issue to the fore. And Zelensky was elected because Ukrainians are sick and tired of the corruption. And one of the, you know, we at Heritage, you know, we said we weren't in favor of the supplemental. The number one reason that we weren't in favor was because of the issue in corruption. It wasn't because of the Ukrainians. It was because of this administration basically going to dump $10 billion into them and just see what happens. And I'll tell you what happens, and Ukrainians will be the first to tell you this. When you flood the country with money, you fuel corruption. You don't fight it.
Right.
So,
is the point, I'm sorry to interrupt, but this is the point that Indiana Representative Victoria Spartz was making, who was a Ukrainian, of Ukrainian extraction. And, you know, she's sort of got, she's getting, you know, backhanded by some members of the Republican caucus. She's had a bit of an exchange with one of Zelensky's top guys about corruption. But that seemed to me the issue that she was raising, and she got a bunch of static for it.
Yeah, my guy that works on these issues here is one of the world's leading experts on providing foreign assistance and humanitarian assistance in conflict zones. He ran hundreds of millions of dollars programs in places where people are shooting and bombing each other, in places like Iraq. And he took one look at that bill and he said, you cannot throw this much country money at this country this fast and not actually increase and enhance corruption. So there's a lot of legitimate issues to say, oh, Jesus, but it's about the way our president is leading. Just like the withdrawal from Afghanistan, a lot of people had a lot of different issues with how we should deal with Afghanistan. But it was very difficult to argue that the president had the right answer. And right. So I think we have to be able to separate these things. Look, we are unbelievably lucky in so many, we have dodged so many bullets. You know, so for example, Finland and Sweden wanting to join NATO, both have important militaries, significantly contributes to NATO. Have you heard about the Southern Gas Corridor? So this is gas coming from Azerbaijan to Europe, helping people get off of Russian energy. That happened against the opposition of the Obama administration, against the opposition of Europeans and leaders like Angela Merkel. Matter of fact, the only reason why it got completed was because of Donald Trump, who convinced the Italians in the end, against against opposition, which basically is funded by the Russians, to let them finish the pipeline. And now, of course, they all need this. So people in the world, nobody wants to be a suburb of Beijing or Tehran or Moscow. And they don't want us to do their heavy lifting for them. They got a dog in this fight. But, you know, we got to be smart about this. And smart and Biden were two words that you really hear, well, if they ever went together.
So end of last week, you had this UN-backed agreement between Russia and Ukraine to provide grain exports. So the concerns about mass starvation in in substantial parts of the world didn't come to be. And then Russia turned right around and launched a missile strike at the, on the port city of Odessa, the only port city that they don't control in Ukraine at this point.
Right.
So what are we to make of that and how this, and again, sort of just state of play here as we're understanding how the balance of power, what the balance of power is in this fight to repel the Russians.
Yeah, there's a couple of different interesting angles there. One is cutting the deal actually made the Russians look weak. And the reason why the Russians cut the deal was because they were getting enormous pressure from the global south, particularly in the Middle East and Africa, because the Russian line was, hey, this is all about, it's not our fault. This is about EU sanctions. That's why the grain's not going. One is nobody was buying that. And they were actually giving the Russians a lot of heat. And the other one was, dude, we don't care because we're starving. We need the food.
Right.
So the fact that Russians had to cut the deal showed that their propaganda in the Middle East and Africa and Latin America largely wasn't working, and they were looking disingenuous and getting heat. So that's good. But then I think in typical Putin style, he doesn't want to look weak. So he signs the deal, and then he turns around and lobs missiles into Odessa to show, oh, look, I'm really strong. So it's kind of typical Putin.
What about the...
You know, I got to say, too, the missing angle in the story that nobody talks about. The reason why these food shortages are exacerbating is, one, because the Russians are blocking exports by Ukraine. That's pretty obvious. But the other one is, when this whole thing started, the first thing China started doing was hoarding grain and not really caring about anybody else. Today, China holds 50% of the world's grain reserves. So they're like, we're going to take care of China and screw everybody else. So the reason why there are shortages is, one, the Russian war, two, China's hoarding grain, and three, so are other countries, which are more concerned about keeping their own domestic prices low than they are about other people. So in Argentina, for example, they banned exports because the economy is a shambles, the government's in terrible place. So they're artificially subsidizing domestic prices, and they're not exporting food. So there's a lot of people to blame here, but all this was really triggered by Putin being such a jerk.
And perhaps by the United States pushing all these countries into NATO, right?
No, I don't think that's right at all. No.
Really?
I mean, look, long history of that. I mean, I've been studying this issue for many decades. So when we did an enlargement in the 1990s, the Russians could have cared less. They did nothing. They didn't care. And this is really Putin. Right. And this is propaganda that somehow this is because the West threatens Russia. Matter of fact, if you look at the trend line of NATO force structure beginning in 1989, it is nothing but getting smaller. So the notion that somehow adding, you know, Montenegro or, you know, to NATO is a threat to Russia, that's nonsense. Because, you know, at the end of Obama's presidency, we didn't have one operational tank in Western Europe. So there was no military threat to Russia. That's just nonsense, right? This is all created. This is a narrative which Putin has really created. If anything, NATO has been the one thing that has really kept Europe from falling apart, because it wasn't Europeans. It wasn't people like Angela Merkel who were trying to turn Europe over to the Russians. So NATO's not the problem. And I know people think, well, that seems plausible, right? Otherwise, why would Putin do this? I mean, what rational person would be attacking the West unless they legitimately felt threatened? And the answer is Vladimir Putin would. He's the guy that would do that.
I want to get your reaction to, since we just had the season finale of the Jan 6th hearings last week, want to get your reaction to that. John Solomon over at Just the News makes the point that this memo that recounts a meeting on January 3rd of 2021 in the White House with then acting Defense Secretary Christopher Miller and Mark Milley, chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, with Trump on national security matters, all but exonerates Trump. The complete passage: Mr. Miller and Jen Milley met with President White House at 5:30 p.m. This is from the Pentagon Inspector General. The primary topic they discussed was unrelated to the scheduled rally. Jen Milley told us that at the end of the meeting, the president told Mr. Miller there would be a large number of protesters on January 6th. Mr. Miller should ensure sufficient National Guard or soldiers would be there to make sure it was a safe event. General Milley told us that Mr. Miller responded, "We've got a plan and we've got it covered." So they had a meeting 3 days before January 6th. The president raised with SecDef there would be a large number of protesters. Miller should have National Guard or soldiers to make sure it's safe. Milley told us that the Pentagon, that the Secretary of Defense responded, "We've got a plan and we've got it covered."
Yeah, I think for John Solomon, he's doing phenomenal work, and his reporting has been awesome. Look, I mean, there's, regardless of where you're Republican, Democrat, whatever, there's two things which are inescapably true, which we actually knew before the January 6th hearing starts. One is, it's a witch trial, right? Regardless of what you think about what happened on the day and how to get to truth, this was a political instrument designed to do nothing other than go after, you know, President Trump, period. I mean, there's no seriousness, there's no bipartisanship, there's no real investigation. The other thing which we knew before, which is demonstrably true, and one of the reasons why we actually know it's a witch trial, because it's never been addressed by the commission, is there's only one person who's responsible for the disaster on January 6th at the end of the day. And the responsible person is Nancy Pelosi, because in the end of the day, she and the head of the Senate have to agree on how to protect the Capitol building. There is more than enough evidence to suggest that the measures that took were completely inadequate for public safety, that a large deployment of the National Guard, not fencing or anything else, would have absolutely quelled everything and ensured the safety and security of the building. It was a responsible measure to take. We do it all the time, all kinds of things. She had all the intelligence she needed to make that call. She didn't make it. She made the wrong call. At the end of the day, she is the responsible figure for this failure. And if there's a threat to democracy, it was caused by her.
He is Lieutenant Colonel Jim Carafano of the Heritage Foundation. Jim, thanks as always. Appreciate it.
Thanks, guys. I feel it's better. You guys are better than caffeine in the morning. Thanks.
Hey, we got you all revved up, ready to go. Seize the day. And he joined us on the turnkey.pro answer line.
If you're talking about it, Dan and Amy are talking about it. It's Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer. See Dennis Prager at Cigar Night on Thursday, August 18th at the Humidor Cigar Lounge in Lyle. Tickets on sale now at 560theanswer.com/cigar.
Top of the morning, Dan, and in for Amy J. This morning is John Cass, johncassnews.com, for his columns and the Chicago Way podcast as well.
And only $50 a year at johncassnews.com.
I bargain at twice the price.
You know, I'm going to take an ad, not in the paper, but here.
Yeah.
And I think people, because I'm told that some people don't know where to find me.
JohnCassNews.com?
Yeah, they will find me.
Okay.
All right.
Advertise and they will come. Two of the leading scientific lights of the last two decades, when I offer that preface, you immediately think what name or names?
Tongue in cheek. Let's go.
Al Gore,
of course,
would be one.
Invented the internet, married to Tipper, hated Black Sabbath.
Formerly married to Tipper.
Oh, yes, formerly.
Yeah.
She dumped him.
And I know you're going to say Tony Fauci, but Deborah Birx is in the category. Let's hear from them. First, Al Gore making a rare reappearance on Meet the Press over the weekend. And then Deborah Birx hawking a book with Neil Cavuto on Fox Business. So one, of course, on the climate apocalypse, and the other on the COVID apocalypse. First, Al Gore.
You know, the climate deniers are really in some ways similar to all of those almost 400 law enforcement officers in Uvalde, Texas, who were waiting outside an unlocked door while the children were being massacred. They heard the screams, they heard the gunshots, and nobody stepped forward. And God bless those families who've suffered so much. And law enforcement officials tell us that's not typical of what law enforcement usually does. And confronted with this global emergency, what we're doing with our inaction and failing to walk through the door and stop the killing is not typical of what we are capable of as human beings. We do have the solutions. And I think these extreme events that are getting steadily worse and more severe are really beginning to change minds.
Mm-hmm. You changed my mind. I thought climate deniers were witches. Now I see them as Uvalde cops.
Yeah.
Thanks, Al.
Stop the killing. If only we would stop the climate denier. I don't deny the climate exists. I don't deny what the data suggests. I just deny that we're all dead in 10 years. Well, actually, Al had us dead a couple of years ago.
It'll take me 10 years just to save for a down payment for my Tesla.
AOC has us dead in 10, I suppose. I mean, again, you know, you talk to actual experts in the space as we have, like Patrick Moore and Bjorn Lomborg and Michael Schellenberger. Mm-hmm. So many others. And they'll give you sort of a balanced understanding of what we know, what we don't know, what some of the concerns are. And that's completely lost by these eco-alarmists like Al Gore, who's made a post-Senate career on fomenting fear.
And profiteering. Aren't they not all profiteering?
Man of science. Man of science. Deborah Birx, woman of science. Deborah Birx has a book out. She's making the rounds, and she was on with Cavuto the other day offering sort of a remarkable statement on the jabs.
Well, if you're across the South and you're in the middle of this wave, what's going to save you right now is Paxlovid. But once we get through this wave, during that lull, you should get vaccinated and boosted because we do believe it will protect you, particularly if you're over 70. I knew these vaccines were not going to protect against infection, and I think we overplayed the vaccines, and it made people then worry that it's not going to protect against severe disease and hospitalization. It will, but let's be very clear. 50% of the people who died from the Omicron surge were older, vaccinated.
Were older and vaccinated.
How many people lost their jobs, their careers because of this, because of what they said?
Well, wait a second.
Wait.
Well, right, and are still losing. The, I
yes,
mean,
they
still
are.
Still targeted military and others. And so I knew that the vaccines weren't going to stop the spread. We're not going to prevent infection. Is that how they were offered up?
No.
For more on this, perfect segue, pleased to be joined by Hal Conte, who's a graduate student at the Center for Cultural and Media Policy Studies at Warwick University. He's written a piece, Why the West Fell for Scientism. How do we fall for and continue to fall for the Al Gore's and the sad little man's and the Deborah Birx's of the world? It's a great question. He explores it. Hal, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
Great piece, Hal. Wonderful.
Yeah, no,
piece.
We appreciate it. Yeah, no, I mean, I think that one of the things that we have to think about is that really, I mean, in the past, I would say the past half century, maybe a little more, maybe a little less, there's been a tendency to present policy positions as somehow objective or scientifically based or somehow like removed from actual debate. So when people invoke things like science in the political sphere, that's usually meant to say that this has been settled by this team of people who know a lot more than you.
So shut up. Right.
Clearly.
Right.
Yeah. I mean, it can come down to that for sure. And I think that one of the most damaging things about the pandemic is that no debate was really allowed about how to deal with many of these different situations. Obviously, we've seen now that a bunch of claims made by many people were very inaccurate, and a lot of people were really silenced for saying other things. And a lot of this goes with this posturing of this idea of neutrality. And I think that's what really was attractive about the use of science, really from, because this was in the mid the Cold War, America kind of wanted to prove that we as a country were doing better than the Soviet Union. So we invested a lot of money in science. We invested a lot of money in science education. And of course, before then, we had always justified ourselves according to the humanities. A lot of our authority, if you look at Britain today, I'm calling from the UK, you still, a lot of people and politicians still have degrees in things like philosophy or literature or whatever. But we really began to see science as kind of the weight that by way democratic liberalism would prove itself against Soviet communism. But certainly we've begun to use science and use it in a way that is very authoritarian in political discussions, I would argue.
Well, right. I mean, we had and you mentioned this in your piece, too. You write, as the professions took on an ever more white-coated, white-collar character, politics, too, became dominated by abstract economic models, so-called evidence-based public policy making. And there's something to that. I mean, it's fine to use the scientific method to develop research that tries to measure the impacts of various public policy choices. So you make intelligent ones and you're thinking about outputs, not just inputs. That's all good. But when you do something like we did, for example, with the pandemic, which is take one person's model of the potential impact of COVID and the death tolls that will accumulate if we don't, for example, lock down our economies, and that then politicians use that to say, well, this model, University College London has produced this model, and it says 2.3 million Americans are going to die if we don't lock down, so we got to lock down. To use that as the basis and to suggest that anybody who raises questions about that modeling is somehow not interested in saving lives, you know, that's when you have the thing off the rails.
I think really what happened was the danger with kind of, it's almost placing all your faith in this one model. And of course, no model can be an absolute replication of the real world. It can't encompass absolutely everything. So a lot of people who reference things like, oh, maybe it's important to have like kids in schools or various things we know now were probably a better idea than not a good idea. A lot of these things were just not allowed to be part of the mainstream discussion. And I think that was a shame. I mean, right now in the UK, they're having a government inquiry into the handling of COVID. A lot of people are saying they really should put children and really what they had to go through at the top of the agenda. But really all these models, the economic models, they're good to use. Like I understand, obviously we use them, but whenever you take like a view that you use one metric as the only way that you can judge all of events, well, that's not how really people live in the real world.
Yes, yeah, but, and by the way, Imperial College London, not University College, Imperial College London, that Neil Ferguson epidemiologist dude, that's who I was referring to.
But hell, the use of the expert, the rise of the expert to give policymakers, politicians, the moral right, apparently, publicly moral right, to dictate how we live so that I couldn't go to church on Sundays, but I could go to a strip club or buy my lottery tickets at the liquor store on a Sunday. How does that all play? And how do people react to that? I mean, I think we're seeing that now, right?
I mean, I think certainly a lot of experts really, some people use the word beclowned themselves during the pandemic. They said a lot of things that were very inconsistent or incoherent about certain types of gatherings versus other types of gatherings. But ultimately, I think it's a lot of people really will have lost trust in science during this. And I think that that's to a certain extent a shame, like that. Yes. We see this abuse of science in a way that really, I mean, I'm not saying that all these people had like devious intentions. I really believe most didn't. But I also believe there was an element of we have to get through this. We're going to either not really investigate it ourselves because we really don't want to look at it head on. Or we're to a certain level, I think at a certain point to certain people, it became we're going to have to tell a noble lie to people, what they thought was a noble lie, because we need to kind of keep society cohesive, but I just don't think that public officials should be laundering policy positions as somehow scientific or objective. I'm not really sure if that's like in the spirit of free thought, which of course science is method based, but there's always an element of an interest in trying to learn more. It seems like a lot of people were invoking science to try to get people to think less.
Yeah, right. Science and data, science and data, science and data. You don't have to listen to what comes next. You just need to know I'm a man or woman of science and data. And so listen to what I have to say. And you write in your piece, in science and the social sciences, liberalism found the neutral vehicle its proponents had long dreamed of. This is, to me, a key point. You know, this isn't about politics, Hal. I'm a man of science and data. So I'm above politics. This is not about the unseemliness of partisan politics. I'm just following the science and data. And therefore, anybody who questions me is making this political because I am a man of science and data.
Oh, yeah. No, I mean, that's a thing which I related this a lot back to the Cold War. My piece was really focused on C.P. Snow. He was an academic at at Cambridge, and he was writing about how there was this gulf between, I don't really know much about science. I'm more of a humanities person. I'm a media degree person. But because there is this gap, I mean, most people don't know all these things about science. A lot of people would just think a scientist would immediately know more than them, which is true in this very area. But the problem is then politicians who, I guess, to a certain extent, politicians can tell scientists what things to model for. In the UK, before the winter, there were rumors of another lockdown. It came out, the Spectator magazine, that a bunch of scientists were basically told by the government, you should model for the worst case scenario. So obviously that's going to come out with certain results. And by putting it through these scientists, I'm not saying the scientists' research was false. I'm just saying they were told to model by the politicians to model for a political route.
They're used as useful idiots and vice versa.
And what we've seen now in the aftermath is that we could come up against a serious virus, something even more serious than what was released by the lab in Wuhan, and we don't know what it was and how it happened. And when that happens, when that comes, and it may come, how will the public react to it, given our antipathy toward these mini fascists who told us to not go to church, but we could go to the strip club and buy whiskey on Sunday? How will that work out?
It's a problem because now, next time, let's say it's a virus, let's say there's some element of we learn about some scandal with drugs or some other sort of thing which the public isn't really inclined to believe at first glance. I would just argue that beyond science, just like the overall distrust in all institutions, which really put their credibility on the line as kind of neutral during this pandemic. And a lot of them did not come out looking good. And that is actually a real problem. So there are some people who say, it's good that these institutions have kind of exposed themselves for what they always really were. But you're going to need them eventually. And if people don't ultimately have trust, and my own trust has been kind of dented for sure, then, and probably a lot of people more than kind of, then we're not in a very good place.
He is Hal Conte, graduate student at the Center for Cultural and Media Policy Studies at Warwick University across the pond. Hal, thanks so much for joining us. Appreciate it.
Thank you very much.
You joined us on the Turnkey.pro answer line.
This is the Morning Show. More Chicago radio listeners are choosing. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560. The Answer. This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560. The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and in for Amy J. This morning is John Cass, johncassnews.com. John, Corey DeAngelis writing in the Wall Street Journal. The American Federation of Teachers commissioned a survey of likely voters in battleground states, finding that 39% of respondents had more confidence in Republicans to deal with education issues versus 38% who had more confidence in Democrats. The number one problem in public schools, according to the respondents for this survey, AFT, the union survey, education has become too politicized. So that's the perspective of parents. By the way, 39-38 advantage for Republicans, that is a huge move from where it normally is.
That is seismic.
In 2017, Gallup had Democrats up by 19 points on the education question.
And that doesn't, does that include independents? Because a lot of people consider themselves independents.
Well, I understand, but I mean, yeah.
Just in terms of partisan affiliation,
yeah, you go
seismic shift.
Yeah, it is massive. And it's, so the parents' perspective is education has become too polarized. Because
that's what the unions have done.
Well, but it's that's because we're surveying likely voters. But the interesting additional question is, what about from the teacher's perspective? What's wrong with, what's the primary problem with K through 12 education? Is it the politicization or is it something else?
As a father of a teacher, as a husband of a teacher, I'll say that a lot of the teachers just want to teach. And you put the union bosses together with the Karens of the socialist Karens of the Democratic Party, and what you get is chaos. And that's why people just are leaving in droves. Teachers are leaving in droves, and we need teachers.
Right. So the question is, for those teachers leaving, what is the prevailing reason why teachers are leaving? I've said this for a long time, because Illinois has long been one of the national leaders in teachers leaving the teaching profession, about half do within the first 5 years. And it's not salary and benefits. It historically hasn't been politics either. It's been essentially reasons that fall under the category, I can't do what I got into teaching to do. The system won't let me.
My son's a special ed teacher. What bothered him the most, pardon me, was during the COVID lockdowns, there were special ed kids, his students, who needed help. And they needed in-person help. And they couldn't give it to them. And that was just tearing him apart.
Right. In other words, I couldn't do what I got into teaching to do, which is to help my kids or to instill a love of learning in kids and help them develop and so forth. Well, Tony Kinnant has some survey work that addresses this question of why teachers are leaving the profession from their perspective. It's very interesting. Tony Kinnant is the executive director of the Heterodox Education publication, Chalkboard Review, former STEM coordinator and head instructional coach for Indianapolis Public Schools as well. Tony, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
Morning, gentlemen. Thanks for having me.
So you write in at Chalkboard Review, I set out to confirm a regional understanding of why so many teachers have announced their departure from Midwestern classrooms this year, either abandoning the field altogether or switching school districts. And what did you find?
Well, what I found was something I wasn't expecting, the numbers to go this heavily into what I had suspected from, I get direct messages or calls from, I would say, hundreds of teachers a month. And this was a very difficult survey to get, because it's not like calling a school saying, hey, would you give this survey to all of your teachers that are leaving, is going to be a request that they're going to fulfill. So this was very difficult to actually get these into the hands of teachers who are resigning, and then verify that they are in fact resigning and it's not just some political actor trying to skew the survey. Mm-hmm. And then what we found was that when you made salary an ancillary issue, aka I'm not being paid enough to deal with blank, then we found that 93% of teachers in the Midwest were either leaving because a student behavior that's left unchecked, so a student does something bad, violent, that normally would be taken to the office just sends them back to the classroom with a slap on the wrist, if that, not actually checking unchecked student behavior, or progressive woke politics in the classroom, you know, as was just said a few minutes ago, not being able to just do my job and teach. That is why 93% of teachers in the Midwest are leaving, according to a survey of over 600 teachers.
Tony, how much is the violence issue as a father of a teacher, as a husband of a teacher.
So
what I'm concerned is, because one of the first columns I ever wrote was about a teacher trying to help a student in Chicago, and she was hit in the face with a ball-peen hammer, okay, by that student. He set her up, and nobody wanted to deal with it. They were all afraid.
This has been something that we've been ignoring in a lot of ways since the 1990s, especially in inner city schools. This has now moved from inner city to suburban schools to city schools in general. So obviously, you guys being in Illinois, my being in Indiana, we have other cities in the state that, while they may not have inner city schools, have large city populations. And those schools do have a massive violence issue. In Indianapolis, for example, there's one high school that has to lock their bathrooms during the day. And the students have to be chaperoned on their way to the bathroom. High school students, not elementary students, but like full-grown students, so that they don't go into the bathrooms and kill each other. There's one high school in Indianapolis with three separate Instagram accounts that cover fights throughout the day. There was another school in Indianapolis, which the principal told us, this was in one of my last meetings in Indianapolis that I was allowed to attend. She told us that they had submitted 13 expulsion requests to the district, as in the student is incredibly violent. We're terrified of the student. Please get him out. And the district denied every single one of those requests. So, of course, as a teacher, I wouldn't want to stay in there. The last few days of my wife finishing her teaching at an incredibly violent Indianapolis, not inner city, but still a very violent elementary school. I was so grateful. She was pregnant during a large part of her last year, and I was terrified some kid was going to punch her in the stomach.
I mean, just that phrase, a very violent elementary school, is chilling. You know, from the survey, 93% you say student behavior or politics, but a majority is student behavior. A majority by itself is student behavior. So this is gotten some attention, but maybe not the attention it deserves, at least from the teacher's perspective. And this is all part of this, it seems to me, from the case studies, this we're going to end the prison, the school to prison pipeline. And so that means we're not going to discipline students in any material way, almost regardless of what they do. And we saw this actually play out in horrific form in Parkland. Because the shooter in Parkland was a known quantity, and they took the approach. And by the way, one of the administrators there was from Chicago, who was doing the same things here. They took the approach that you know, we don't want to ostracize, we don't want to discipline.
It was an Obama policy.
We're going to sort, you know, we're going to normalize and look for alternatives to imposing the kind of discipline and taking the sort of steps that are required to address what obviously turned out to be a lethal threat within the school.
You know, it's funny you mention that. There's actually a lot of Chicago alumni that are around the country that are, you know, bringing these really silly, very dangerous, very harmful policies to their school districts. There were a lot of them at Indianapolis, and they were so proud. They were Chicago public school alumni, and some of the rest of the staff and I, some of the rest of the administration and I looked at them like they were from another planet, because the ideas that they brought to the table were just so bad. And there's nothing quite like saying, oh, well, I'm an alumni of one of the worst performing schools in the country and bragging about it. It's like, you know, going up to someone and saying, oh, well, you know, I'm, you know, an alumni of the Generals, you know, playing the Harlem Globetrotters. It's like all you do is get trounced. What are you bragging about?
Right. Well, but so speak to that. I mean, especially with your interaction with teachers. I mean, we have these anecdotes, but teachers obviously are not finding support from the administrators, from the school boards, from the parents. Is it your view that it's a combination of all three of those stakeholder groups that are failing in these schools where teachers are fleeing based on this issue?
Well, it's the first two out of the three, way more than parents. Although parents for a long time, I wouldn't say in an excessively negative or malicious way, but more in an apathetic way. Mm-hmm. You didn't have to care about education if you were a parent in this country for a long time. But then when COVID hit, a lot of parents discovered kind of the harmful effects of that apathy and have redoubled their efforts ever since. But as far as administrators, oh, yeah, absolutely. I mean, so many teachers are completely ignored by their administrators, by their state legislators. They're expected to jump through endless hoops for licensure and for all of this garbage, useless professional development. And it's simply not worth it anymore. And a lot of them, I was just talking about it this morning, you actually see a larger amount of teacher shortage schools in these inner city, heavily left-leaning controlled areas, as opposed to the rural areas. And then also private schools are seeing very little in terms of teacher shortage at all.
So is the answer then more school choice? And I think in Indiana, school choice is proceeding. But is that the answer? More school choice? Parents pull their kids out, forcing then these recalcitrant administrators of public systems to get their act together?
No, it is an answer, but it is not the answer. It's a part of the equation. But school choice is simply not going to fix the nation and its education issues. You're still looking at dozens, if not every state's issue with licensure requirements, with where they get teachers from, how they're confirmed, how they are given freedom or authority over their own careers, much less actions within, you know, teaching and the administration of minors and juveniles. I think that school choice is an incredibly necessary part. I'm a good friend of Corey DeAngelis. We talk about this all the time. School choice is a necessary step, but you can't just privatize or deregulate one part of the system. It needs to be total and complete. Otherwise, it's going to be like the American healthcare system. You're going to be riding this fence and everyone's going to be hurt.
He is Tony Kinnett, executive director of the Heterodox Education publication, Chalkbird Review, and the former STEM coordinator and head of instructional coach for Indianapolis Public Schools. Check out his piece, which I'll tweet out at DanProf. 615 Midwestern teachers reveal why they're really leaving the classroom. Really important survey. Hopefully it generates some conversation within school districts who want to keep good teachers. Tony Kinnett, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
Thank you, gentlemen.
And he joined us on the Turnkey.pro answer line.
Listen to Dan and Amy on your smartphone. Download the AM560 mobile app today at 560theanswer.com/mobile. Only the biggest stories, only the biggest guests, and only the biggest opinions. This is AM560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan, and in for Amy J. This morning, John Cass, johncassnews.com for his columns and the Chicago A podcast. The government may kill the auto industry in this country, yet they almost did when they protected it. Well, if there's anything you don't want economically, it's government's protection. That was back in the 70s.
We're the government. We're here to help.
Now it's through incentivizing malinvestment. Good piece over the weekend by Holman Jenkins in the Journal, The Upside-Down Logic of Electric SUVs. If consumers cared, and consumers and businesses cared about CO2, they admit, the last cars they might buy are hot-selling EVs like Ford Mustang Mach-E or GM's Hummer EV. These large battery, long-range vehicles would have to be driven many tens of thousands of miles before they rack off enough mileage and save enough gasoline to compensate for the emissions created to produce their batteries. And that's according to their fans, whose calculations often smell of friendly assumptions about the source of the electricity consumed, whether gasoline is really being displaced mile for mile, and a presumed lack of progress in the meantime in reducing the carbon intensity of conventional motor fuels. Most problematic of all is the assumption that EV use causes oil to stay in the ground. Right. He goes on to add Ford's announcement last week of layoffs. Ford leaked this week, for the benefit of the investment community, plans to lay off thousands of workers to fatten the profits of its conventional vehicles. This extra cash is needed to support electric vehicles that lose money despite taxpayer rebates, plus hidden subsidies via our convoluted fuel economy and trade regulations. Ford's leak may be a turning point. Conventional vehicles will be starved for investment from here on out, even as automakers throw money at big battery EVs for luxury buyers. He notes this trade-off could actually lead to worse emissions than otherwise, considering that most non-rich consumers will likely opt for gasoline-powered cars for decades to come. It also represents a gamble with the industry's finances, which depend on large government-protected profits from standard SUVs and pickups. He concludes, Our EV policies are mainly a testament to modern society's ability to create complexity when it starts trying to hit multiple political bogeys, even if it means ignoring the bogey that they originally set off the policy quest, in this case, carbon reduction. Some $526 billion is currently being invested to create dozens of mostly high-end electric vehicles aimed at the 17% of buyers who constitute the luxury market. The impact on climate of these cars will be zero. Let's hope the impact on taxpayers will be zero when the bills come due. For more on this, we're pleased to be joined by one of the great producers of chart porn in academic circles. He is Mark Perry, professor of economics and finance at the University of Michigan and Carpe Diem blogger for the American Enterprise Institute. Mark, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
Hi, Dan. Hi, John.
Good. Hey, hello, Mark. Thanks for being with us. So tell us, to what Holman Jenkins is writing about. You've got sort of the specifics, one of your wonderful narrative destabilizing pie charts on electric vehicles and their fuel sources.
Yeah, well, I think there's this kind of false illusion that if you're driving an electric vehicle that it's somehow powered by windmills and solar panels, you know, just this fantasy, this green fantasy, when the reality is I just looked at the fuel sources for U.S. electric generation. These are national figures. And so the electricity that people are putting in their electric vehicles, well, almost 41% comes from natural gas and almost 24% comes from coal. So about two-thirds of the electricity is generated by fossil fuels. In fact, coal is the dirtiest fossil fuel. So these people are putting coal into their coal-powered, you know, electricity into their electric vehicles. Then you've got another 22% for nuclear. So, you know, something like 86% of electricity is generated from fossil fuels and you know, nuclear, which the environmentalists don't like. And then only less than 6% of electricity comes from windmills and solar panels. So I think that's the reality of the way electricity is produced. I don't think it's going to change very much. I mean, wind and solar might contribute a little more in the future, but basically electric cars are fueled by almost two-thirds by fossil fuels.
Mark, this is John Cass. Listen, a question. What do you do with the batteries of all these great environmentally cool cars? What happens to the batteries?
Well, that's another issue that maybe it seems so far into the future that people don't have the reality of that yet sinking in. But, yeah, so eventually the batteries wear out. They're very expensive to replace. And then what do you do with the old ones?
Dump them into the Pacific and create, like, artificial reefs so Dan and I can go fishing there?
Yeah. Well, yeah. And, you know, the other thing I just found out, I didn't realize this, a lot of people don't realize this probably, is that electric vehicles are much heavier than gas-powered cars because of the batteries are so heavy. So they're putting more wear and tear on the road, and at the same time, they're not paying gas taxes because they're not using gasoline. So it's like they're getting free use of the roads, and they're putting greater wear and tear on the roads than gasoline-powered vehicles. So there's a lot of issues. Plus, you know, Ford is laying off workers. Another reality is that electric cars don't have as many parts as a gasoline-powered car, so you need fewer workers. So there's some projections that we're going to have then layoffs of up to 35,000 auto workers because they won't need as many to build electric cars as, you know, regular gas-powered cars. So there's a lot of realities here, I think, that we need to face going forward.
You know, putting your economist hat on, what about the point that Holman Jenkins makes, one of the points he makes in this piece I was referencing, this gamble the industry's taking with the government's backing, both in terms of the protected profits from standard SUVs and pickups, as well as these subsidies that are, you know, would need to not only go on in perpetuity, but potentially increase in order to be profitable for the EVs?
Yeah, you know, I just think that once the government gets involved, and I know that they're doing a lot of EV mandates, so they're mandating that automakers produce a certain percentage or share of their fleet as, you know, electric vehicles. And so I just think, yeah, there is going to be a huge distortion in the market. I'm still thinking that people aren't really sold on electric vehicles, other than the fact that they do get state and federal rebates. So there is some, there are some financial incentives. But again, and it just doesn't seem like it's going to be that popular in terms of, you know, people being able to afford the electric cars and then paying for, you know, the charging stations in their garages or something. And then what do you do all, well, for all the people who don't have a single family home with a garage? How do you get their cars charged? And I mean, it just seems like there's just a lot of unanswered questions, and I just don't see this working out well, especially with this huge amount of government involvement.
I can't wait for the day when Prius drivers will be depicted as rebels in maybe leather jackets, and leather pants, as freedom.
Right, the Easy Riders and
Easy Rider
and Priuses.
Boys. Yeah.
Hey, I wanted to. This is a related story and a related chart. I always like this chart of the century that you do, which is price changes over a period of time, to look at how some goods and services increase in price and other goods and services decline in price relative to inflation and average hourly wage increases and so forth. So price changes January of 2000 to June of 2022. Average hourly wages, 90% increase over the course of that two-decade period. Overall inflation, a little bit less than that, about 75%. But just talk to us about the things that have outpaced inflation in terms of price increase and those that have risen at less than the rate of inflation or even declined in real terms over that same period of time, and what it tells us about how we should conceive our economy.
Yeah, well, it's just really interesting. People find this chart really interesting because when we look at the goods or services that have gone up in real terms, either compared to average inflation or compared to wages, you know, I mean, the services that have gone up the most are hospital services and then college tuition, college textbooks, medical care services, and child care, nursery school. And so those are areas that have huge government involvement, either, you know, directly or through subsidizing college by having federally insured student loans. So it's kind of like the story is the greater the government involvement and the greater the degree of regulation, the higher the prices go relative to consumer prices in general or compared to wages. And then you look at the goods and services that have gone down in real terms compared to overall inflation and wages are things like new cars, household furnishings, which would be, you know, furniture, household goods, clothing and apparel. And, of course, a lot of that is from overseas. So it's also the greater the degree of international competition, then those goods and services have stayed relatively or actually increased in affordability. Cell phone services, computer software, toys and TVs. So those are the goods and services that we buy as Americans that have actually gone down in real terms. And those are either because we have greater degrees of international competition, like for clothing and household furnishings, or, you know, it's just, yeah, there's less regulated sectors of the economy, like, let's say, consumer software and toys and TVs. There's probably not a lot of government regulation. And so I think the story is that the greater the degree of government involvement, the more expensive goods and services get, and the lower the degree of government involvement, the more affordable goods and services get, and the more international competition we have, the better it is for consumers in terms of affordability of goods and services.
So last week when we had Mayor Pete, their Secretary of Transportation, making the case before congressional committees that, you know, you need to continue the government investment in EVs. You need to increase it, actually, because that way you'll get to scale. And then once we get to scale, once we've provided the funding for automakers to get to scale, that's when you'll see the prices drop. And so that was his response to the fact that, right, the median price of an electric vehicle right now is like north of 60 grand, which is about the median household income in this country. So it's a little tough to figure out how everybody's going to buy the EV that Pete wants them to buy. But anyway, that's his argument is subsidize our way to scale, and then you'll see a reduction in price once you achieve scale. But that's not how it actually works in the real world, or frankly, even in economic theory. But we're just but I want to get your reaction to that, because that was my reaction.
Yeah, I mean, maybe you could get some temporary improvements, just like the way that they subsidize electric vehicles now with state and federal tax credits. But, you know, that's not really sustainable in the long run. You can't do that really forever. And so you can get some artificial temporary stimulus effects from government involvement. But in the long run, we have to face the economic fundamentals of, you know, the energy reality, scientific reality, economic realities of supply and demand. So people like Buttigieg, you know, they're kind of disconnected from economic and scientific realities, so they can say those kinds of things. But in the long run, we can't really deviate too far away from the economic and scientific fundamentals that they seem to find it convenient to ignore, at least in the short run.
He is Mark Perry, professor of economics and finance at the University of Michigan, and Carpe Diem blogger for the American Enterprise Institute. That's a blog worth checking out routinely. Mark, thanks for joining us as always. Appreciate it.
Thanks, Dan. Thanks, John.
And he joined us on the Turnkey.pro answer line.
It's what Chicago is talking about. It's Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan and Amy on AM 560, The Answer.
Thanks for listening to Chicago's Morning Answer podcast, sponsored by Signature Bank. Signature Bank takes pride in helping customers grow their business and provide unmatched banking expertise, custom financial solutions, and the industry's best technology. So whether you're a business looking for a deposit relationship or needs a ready source of financing, Signature Bank is the right bank for you. Call today at 773-467-5600 to hear how Signature Bank can help your business grow and thrive. Member FDIC, Equal Housing Lender.